Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Okay, welcome to this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, the Sunday version, as it were. And if you're listening to this in the Phoenix market, maybe, or Seattle, or San Antonio, I think you may be aware that we record both a Friday and a Sunday show on our Houston flagship, KSEV. AM 700, and then we send that audio out to the other cities, several of them. But in any event, it's same content, same agenda. We talk about real estate news that affect the commercial real estate sector primarily, even if it's a article about single family or a story about single family homes. It's typically got a or has some connective tissue to what's going on in occupancy or absorption or rent rates, rental growth rates in the multifamily market. And boy, are we seeing a lot of that in the current state of affairs. But in any event, for those of you that listen every week, you know that we always start off by reminding you that just because you listen to our radio programs or see us on a website, etc., that does not make you a client, and you should always consult with your current legal, accounting, tax, and real estate mentors, professionals, advisors, etc., before you rush off and try to implement something that may not be appropriate for your facts and circumstances. So please check with those folks. If you don't have any or all of the above and you would like to speak with us, feel free to go to our BAPlanner.com website. That's BEAPLANNER.com. And you'll see at the top right, close to the top right, next to the top right, is a forms link. If you would be kind enough to complete at least step one of that four-step process. The more we have, the more specific we can be when we chat with you on the phone about the information you submit, and you can book that call at the link right at the next link over, the far right link, call. And that'll take you to our introductory call submission form. And if you would be kind enough to fill that out, we will be happy to spend a few moments, maybe half an hour or more, on the phone and help you understand if and how we think we can sync up with helping you meet your objectives. So in any event, let's pivot and go to the news that has occurred this week. Let's see here, which article are we going to start with today? I've added, three or four since Friday's show. I guess we'll just take them in order. The first article, or the first link in black type, is the little title section, in any event, is a article that was in Globe Street, or on GlobeStreet.com, December 14th. More apartment construction heads to the low rent suburbs is the title, and if the subtitle is rent growth in low rent suburbs has outperformed higher rent suburbs and the urban core counterparts. That's a bit of a turnabout, and since that's where most of our client apartment buildings, or the buildings that our clients are invested in, as the case may be, that's a good thing. But typically, the new supply, those coming online, has skewed towards the suburban markets with higher rents. 40% of the market rate multifamily housing has been built in these suburbs, while urban cores received 25%. In both cases, the deliveries were disproportionately higher than each submarket's share of the nation's apartment stock. But the nation's apartment stock is a changing, and there's a ton of units coming online. I guess just restricting our discussion to Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, San Antonio, Austin. Let me see here. I have a summary that gives me some up to the month information on what those dynamics look like. Let's see here. We've got, and these are averages, and never forget what I say about the averages. Averages are marketing terms. You know, you and I are both actual. We're normal, as hell I'm going to say it. But if you look at the occupancy rates compared, you know, comparing Dallas or Austin, Houston, DFW, and San Antonio, the Texas markets are showing a little weakening in those rates. San Antonio is dropped down to 87.9%. Let's see, I don't have the comparative on what it dropped down from, but it was higher a month ago, if I recall. Houston's 89.1, Austin's 86.7. That's continuing to decline. And then DFW is 90.4% of the largest Texas markets. DFW is still doing the best. Let's see here. Within the Houston market, since I think most of our listeners hail from Houston, I'll tell you the strongest markets, annualized growth rate-wise, Memorial Spring Branch is 5%. Highway 249, Woodlake and Westheimer, those are 1.6, 1.7% respectively. That's positive growth. So despite a lot of the negative news you hear or read about, Houston's apartment crowd is still doing fairly well. Now, we don't break this down by asset class. I need to try to get more information where we can look at that on a Class C basis versus maybe Class B. I think most of our clients are in Class C apartments, but it is across a lot of units. It's, let's see, an operating supply of 744,000 units across 3,000 apartment communities in Houston. The unit number, unit count proposed for construction is 34,000 in 111 different communities. That's pretty amazing when you think about the times we're in. Now that's proposed. That's not permitted and that's not funded. Units actually under construction, there's 22,000, almost 22,500 across 85 communities, still pretty strong. And recent openings are 25,813 in 96 communities. Again, pretty strong market numbers for Houston. Dallas is comparable. Units under construction is higher, 43,852, and another 77,000 plus proposed. That's a lot of apartments, a lot of units. And, you know, part and parcel of it is the fact that the single family sales are significantly down given the difficulty of getting mortgages and the rates. You know, let's face it, the rates are higher, lenders are more selective, and the combination is fueling apartment dwellers. And in fact, we've got an article I think we'll discuss here momentarily that indicates that there's like, I think it's a 55% number of tenants that are saying they're definitely renewing. And, you know, when you look, I'll tell you something that's kind of an undercurrent in the apartment market, at least in the Class A category. You know, I think a lot of people that occupy Class A, when you look at the amenity set, and I talked about this on the last show or maybe two shows ago, they probably would not qualify to buy the level of amenity that they're getting in the apartment that they're renting if it were single family. You know, it would be a lot of home purchase price. I mean, I don't know that I've got a direct correlation, but I would hazard a guess. There's some of these Class A apartments that you can rent for a couple thousand bucks a month or so that it's probably equivalent to a $500,000 single family home in terms of the finishes that are in those units. And so if you're a tenant, why wouldn't you rent? And I know a lot of you are going to say, hey, you know, you're not building any savings account in your home if you just rent. Well, you know what? Go out to Har and pick, I don't know, I've done this in the past on condos, and I assume Har still shows this, where it shows you the average price per foot for current year and then goes back in time, back to 2007, 8, 9, et cetera. And, of course, on some of those condo towers, the high-rises, they started first showing up in that time frame. So you can see, okay, this is what it sold for at birth, let's call it. And then you can see what it's selling for now. See how much equity's there. You know, this is Houston, Texas we're talking about. This is not San Francisco. Well, that's a bad example. This is not Los Angeles, or this is not certain other markets where appreciation is expected. And so I'm going to suggest if you can rent, and by the way, I'm not alone in this opinion. I've just been saying this for, I don't know, since the mid-80s when I started my CPA practice. I would have people, typically couples, that would come in, and one of them, and I'll let you guess which one, would always say, well, shouldn't we buy a bigger, more expensive home? Isn't it better for tax purposes? And I would constantly remind them, they being both spouses, that a home, standalone single family versus a multifamily dwelling, is a lifestyle choice. It's not an investment choice when you live in Houston, Texas. And it took a while before I started hearing other people say that. And now the latest generation, and I get confused, is it millennials or Gen Z? I can't keep up. I'm an old man. But in any event, they get it. They're loving life renting. They're not buying the Madison Avenue hype, probably the first generation that hasn't. And, you know, but that doesn't seem to impact new home sales. I don't know how the marketing folks that are working for all the new builders are surmounting that challenge, but it doesn't seem to be daunting their efforts. Let's do this. We're right on the mark here for our first break. Let's go ahead and take it, and we'll be back momentarily with more of this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
People always coming up to me and asking, what's your secret? With all you do, your attitude just seems to be so good. How do you keep it? Well, I'm not the Dalai Lama, but I'll try to offer up a few words of advice. You better get to living, giving. Don't forget to throw in a little forgiving and love along the way. You better get to knowing, showing a little bit more concern about where you're going. There's a word unto the wise. You better get to living.
BeAPlanner.com wants to ask you, when's the last time your tax pro called with a way to save you taxes? Seriously, do you want to work with a planner or a reporter? A planner knows which tax code sections are the best wealth accumulation tools. Less tax, more profit. Learn more at BeAPlanner.com. The Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-581-0195, 713-581-0195. Or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com, Nathan at npross.com.
Have you recently joined a real estate mentor program? BeAPlanner.com shows how real estate investments combined with proactive tax planning can generate significant wealth. However, syndication terms for private real estate partnerships are complicated. They help you assess the benefits of ownership from A acquisition to E exit. A planner wants to know what they are signing up for. BeAPlanner.com with CPA Nathan Ross. BeAPlanner.com.
The song, Bobby McGee, I'm just longing to be free. Take me where I want to be. Big dreams and faded jeans. And there are many just like me.
With big dreams and faded jeans.
Okay, welcome back to more of this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And we had just gone through a couple of the articles in the current news cycle, and I had a couple more I wanted to mention. The next article is here are the most competitive apartment markets. And let's see, this one is another GlobeStreet.com article from, 4 days ago, the 12th. Let's see here. I want to see what they're calling competitive. I'm not sure if it defines which metric. Rental RCI, I knew they had one. Rental it's competitive. I'm not sure about the TY on the end. That's their word. In any event, it's calculated, let's see, it's a measure of markets with the least availability. Let's see, the RCI was 59.5. in 2023 for the U.S. as a whole. So if you're going to be higher, you'll be in the crowd that's the most competitive, I suppose, is the way they're doing this. But in any event, let's see if they identify anything other than averages. Let's see, regionally, the Midwest was the hardest market for renters to break into, with three cities among the top five nationally. The region's lower cost of living, large living spaces facilitating remote work, and access to the great outdoors all helped, the report found. More than two-thirds of the occupiers renewed their leases in almost all Midwestern locations, intensifying the competition among would-be renters. The Midwest is experiencing an economic revival fueled in part by the rise of the REST Fund. I'm not familiar with that, but apparently it was launched by the entrepreneur and investor Steve Case. That would be, I believe, the founder of AOL way back. Assume that's who it's referring to because he would fit the criteria of entrepreneur and investor. Among cities, Miami had the nation's hottest rental market in 2023 with an RCI of 122. That's way over that, 59% or 59.5. Well, it's not a percent, it's just a raw math calculation. So 122 is significantly higher. Despite a 3.7 increase in the number of apartments for rent, the demand exceeded the supply, with 71.2% of renters renewing their leases in the Miami market. There was an average of 22 applicants for each vacant rental. That's insane. I don't know if Houston's ever been in that spot. I'm pretty sure San Antonio hadn't, and I doubt Dallas has. 22 applicants for each vacant rental, and I assume they're calling an applicant someone that bothers to fill out an application, not just somebody that called or maybe came by and took a look at some units. That's pretty impressive. New Jersey's RCI score of 116 put it in second place nationally in 2023, up from fifth in 2022, and it was the only northeastern market to score above 100. An attractive location for millennials seeking affordable housing outside New York City. I guess millennials was the group I was trying to recall earlier. And it had an occupancy rate of 96.3. Man, if that's across the whole state, that again is pretty impressive. With a occupancy rate of 96.3% was 70.5% renewal rate. That's good. 14 renters vying for each unit. Vacant apartments were they were on market 34 days. Took 34 days to rent, making it one of the toughest rental markets in the country, the report found. Next up, in third place, I would not have guessed, Milwaukee came in third with an RCI of 113, despite a 2.9% increase in housing supply since January of this year. Apartments stay on the market for 33 days with 14 renters for each, or 14 applicants for each vacant unit. Less than 5% of the metro's apartments are available at any time, and 70% of renters renew. Wow, Milwaukee sounds like a good apartment investing area. I'll have to dig into that a bit further. I wasn't aware it had skyrocketed to those heights. The expanding healthcare sector helped Grand Rapids, Michigan achieve fourth place with an RCI of 109. Omaha, Nebraska's RCI of 107, an expanding population makes it a real challenge to secure a rental with a 28-day rental turnover. In the Northeast, suburban Philadelphia was the hottest rental market and eighth in the U.S. with an RCI of 99, which helped or was helped out by a lack of new supply and an occupancy rate of 94.7%. You know, these occupancy numbers, you know, you look at you know, individual properties, say in a Houston market, and there are individual properties that are 94% or almost 95 in this case, 94.7. I don't know. I can't recall when the whole market was ever 95%. I don't know. That's an eye opener. In Brooklyn, even wealthy households had difficulty finding apartments given its RCI of 98. Manhattan only took 22nd place, perhaps because its high lease rates discouraged less affluent households. In California, Orange County proved the most competitive. Occupancy stood at 96%, as 60.5% of rent leases were renewed, while 13 households fought for each available vacancy. The market was also tight in San Diego, though only half of the renters renewed their leases. And I've got a client that has, I don't know, 8 or 9, maybe 10 rentals there in San Diego, and they don't seem to have many empties, and they're never long. So I guess that's proving that out. In Silicon Valley, affected by a 1.71% increase in supply, lease renewals were well below the national average. Apartments still moved in 33 days. That's not bad. And despite the layoffs in that area in the last 12 months, the rental market remains moderately competitive, as many of the laid-off tech folks apparently join startups. Some small markets, especially those encouraging startup businesses or located in college towns, also showed rental demand shoot up. Fayetteville, Arkansas, which bills itself the startup city of the South, occupancy stood at 97.2%. Again, very, very good. And new occupants took over within 18 days. 18 days on market on average before a new tenant goes into a vacancy. That's incredible. And that's even with the supply rising by 2.3%. Other competitive small-town markets included Providence, Rhode Island, and Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Anyway, that's a good article by GlobeStreeter. It's a positive article, which I guess is the reason I wanted to make it available on our website. It just goes to show you, as I've said assorted other occasions, averages, national averages, are just not necessarily something you hang your hat on, unless it's maybe, I don't know, mortgage rates would tend to be the same, perhaps, or close to the same across the country. But, you know, the average of many factors is based on your market, if not your sub-market. And so you don't get too bent out of shape when you see national data. And conversely, you don't hang your hat on it when you see it either. You got to dig in and prove it out. Let's see. What else do we have? Let's see. Single-family renters identifying and evolving. I'll tell you what, let's talk about the last of the new ones. Why rising apartment vacancy rates are not here to stay. And I guess this is a optimistic view. I like optimistic views. In any event, the gist of this article is structural trends in the market suggest that the recent rise in apartment vacancy rates will be short-lived. Rental renewal rates have significantly increased since the global financial crisis, as most householders who live in apartments reported being satisfied with their living situations. And again, this I think in part reflects what I've read with other surveys or other calculations, if you look at what it would cost to buy the equivalent level of finishes in a single family home, you can rent it for a lot less. And it's not just that you can rent it for less, but you're able to take whatever the difference is and potentially, and I know everybody says they're going to do this and most people don't, but if they invested the difference in what they would be paying to buy versus rent, they for sure would be better off, assuming they invest wisely. But in any event, the ability to buy that extra nice amenity set or rent the extra nice amenity set without paying for it effectively, that's pretty attractive. Slowing, another reason is slowing multifamily permitting activity indicates that the pace of new apartment deliveries is back on a path to normalization. And again, I'm going to suggest that depends on the individual market and sub-market you're looking at, because I just read you what was going on in the Texas markets, and there's quite a few units coming to market on certain of those sub-markets. You know, Dallas, I think, was one that had 43,000, if I remember right, or 48,000 new units coming. Let's see, which one was that? I thought I still had that up here. Yeah, 43,000 units are under construction. That's already permitted, you know, people swinging hammers out there. But in any event, and that's 147 new apartment communities. So a lot of Class A represented in that number, as is usually the case with new construction. Let's see. Let's look at let me just make sure I covered the points I wanted to on the article about the vacancy rates are not going to continue going up. Let's see. Although they remain near historical lows, apartment vacancy rates in the U.S. have begun to climb. However, the recent reversal may be a temporary trend driven by, again, renter satisfaction and a slowdown in the pace of new construction. There's definitely a slowdown taking place in spite of the numbers that I just gave you, because remember, those were actually started a while ago, so it takes a little bit of time to turn the train around. But in any event, let's see, rental vacancy rates, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, the rental vacancy rates reached their highest point on record in 2009, peaking at 11.1%. Then they proceeded to fall, albeit unevenly, through mid-2022, reaching a low point of 5.6% last year. And so now the trend has reversed in three of the past five quarters. Rental vacancy rates have risen, jumping by one percentage point to 6.5% by the third quarter, 2023. Still not a lot to get excited about. And again, the general consensus is this is a temporary pause in that activity. Let's look at one last article here, and then we'll take our next break. Single-family renters identifying an evolving demographic, and let's see here. This is a newsletter we subscribe to from Arbor. It's a big lender, multifamily lender. They also have a REIT, real estate investment trust, that they lead. But in any event, single-family rental has been a strong market as of late. However, again, it's mixed depending on where you're at. But, you know, the targeting is key with the single-family market, as is multifamilies. Just, you know, typically single families are built in many cases further out, whereas the multifamily guys tend to stick around the major population. Sometimes the single family developments are, you know, a bit removed from, I don't want to say from civilization, but they're certainly not building, you know, 1,000 home subdivisions in downtown of these big, largest metros. The demographic profile of the single-family renter has been consistent in recent years, according to an expert in this area. In terms of the income qualification factor in Class A space, you have about $114,000 household income in multifamily, and that's really consistent in the SFR and BTR. That would be your single family rental and build to rental portfolios as well. That's the company she works for, Mark Taylor Residential. So I guess what they're suggesting is that the demographic for the upscale Class A properties, the target are people that have the household income in the six figures plus. Let's see if there's other I think that's all I really wanted to point out, is where that metric draws the line. But as they say towards the end of the article, every location, every community is different. What works in Scottsdale may not work as well in Tulsa. Boy, you can say that again pretty much any type of real estate. In any event, let's go ahead. We're a little bit late for that last break. Let's go ahead and take our last break, and we will be back with more of the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
Did you know 76% of Americans are concerned they won't have a secure retirement? BeAPlanner.com shows how private real estate partnerships can increase current cash flow and retirement savings. There are three options to control your 401 and IRAs, but only one will double your retirement lifestyle. BeAPlanner.com for the Be a Planner Show with CPA Nathan Ross.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-581-0195, 713-581-0195, or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com, Nathan at npross.com.
Have you recently joined a real estate mentor program? BeAPlanner.com shows how real estate investments combined with proactive tax planning can generate significant wealth. However, syndication terms for private real estate partnerships are complicated. They help you assess the benefits of ownership from A acquisition to E exit. A planner wants to know what they are signing up for. BeAPlanner.com with CPA Nathan Ross. BeAPlanner.com.
Is it easy? No, it ain't. Can I fix it? No, I can't. Well, I sure ain't gonna take it lying down. Will I make it? Maybe so. Will I give up? Oh, no. I'll be fighting till I'm 6 feet underground. I'm gonna woman up and take it like a man. I'm gonna buckle up, be tough enough to take control and make demands. Look like a woman, think like a man, be as good as or better than. Woman up and take it like a man.
Okay, welcome back to the final segment of this week's Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And it's time for our weekly look once again at the usdebtclock.org. And it's kind of like watching train wrecks, you know. It's horrible, but you got to do it. You can't not look, I guess, right? In any event, you know, the national, the U.S. national's debt is getting ready to pass the $34 trillion mark. In fact, by the time we come on the air this coming Friday, well, it won't quite be there. We probably have added about $40 billion. We're about 77 billion away. So it'll take a couple more weeks. It's 6 to 8 billion a day. I've forgotten the exact number, but somewhere in that number should get us up over the top there. But let me point out another. If you do take a look, and we've got the link to the debt clock out on our BeAPlannerShow.com. Site. That's our companion site, and I should have mentioned that earlier. I apologize. That's where you can read the assorted articles that we talk about each week. If you go to the resources news page take a look, you'll see again the articles that I refer to, and we leave them out there. So if you've missed them, feel free to circle back. It's kind of hard to read them while I'm talking, I realize. But anyway, you know, there's a number that I haven't really delineated well on my prior mentions of this usdebtclock.org site. First of all, these are real-time calculations. You see them going on like a pinball machine right there in front of your eyes. But if you look down towards the bottom of that chart on the right, you'll see a number that it's in the red, one of the red sections. It's called U.S. unfunded liabilities. And you'll see that that number is $212,438,000,000. And what that represents, it's not the borrowings that have occurred. That's the number we were talking about earlier up at the top, the U.S. national debt. That's the $33,923,000,000,000, and that per taxpayer works out to $259,000 each. But if you consider the amount of items that we haven't paid for yet but have already been passed by Congress, you know, for future occurrence, like Social Security, indexing, the retirement age, Medicare, etc. Take a look down at that bottom right-hand corner in red where you'll see second number from the right, U.S. unfunded liabilities. These are liabilities that if we were doing accounting in the generally accepted accounting GAAP principle area, we would have this big liability, $212 trillion plus on our balance sheet. That is crazy. But the craziest part of that is look at the rightmost column right next to it, and you'll notice that the liability per citizen, that's man, woman, and child that are citizens in the United States, is $631,168. That's crazy. And the only reason I'm bringing this up, That's the only reason I bring it up every time I discuss it, is to help you understand. Yeah, I don't care if you understand the details on why we're in such a mess. You just need to understand we are in a major financial predicament. And there's not too many ways of framing it in terms of what's going to happen. And it's going to have to be a combination of things, but you can assure yourself that your tax rate is going to go up. That is one component, and unfortunately, that's not going to do much in terms of solving the problem. It's going to take a systemic policy change or policies changes within this country to move the needle significantly on that unfunded liability and on getting our U.S. National debt down. And it's not Democrat, it's not Republican, it's just math. It's my favorite expression. And the Democrats can squawk all they want about raising tax rates. The Republicans can squawk all they want about cutting spending. There's no proposal, no serious proposal on either of those fronts that significantly moves the needle at all on these numbers. And that's it's amazing how fast we've found we find ourselves in this predicament. And hadn't been that long when we had very little, relatively speaking, very little debt. But a great solution would be if we could push a button somewhere and double the GDP. You know, if we could do that, we would effectively bring in the additional tax revenues with much lower raising of the tax brackets, if at all. But that's not something you can just push a button and see happen. And I don't care how many wars we fight. That is one way to get, I guess that raises GDP in a way. That's, again, not the best way. There's a lot of other costs associated with war, and I would say that's not a good idea, obviously. But in any event, so for you to avoid this, the single biggest thing you can do is if you have pre-tax retirement accounts, be it IRAs or 401ks, consider converting over to the Roth side of those retirement accounts. And whether it's a 401k at the office or it's a self-directed 401 that we will show you and explain if you qualify, most of the larger 401k plans at employers nowadays have a Roth component, a Roth side of the house is the way I explain it, like a duplex. And for sure, the self-directed model that we operate with has it. And so you can convert your investments from pre-tax to after-tax by paying the Roth conversion tax. And the interesting thing is that if you do it after you've rolled your money into private company investments, like real estate partnerships, these private partnerships that we talk about often on the air, that they invest in multifamily apartment buildings. And as a private company, the calculations involving the Roth conversion provides for discounts on the money that you would otherwise value, or the amount you would otherwise value those companies at. So you might have a situation where you've invested $100,000 and yet your conversion tax base would be less than that after you apply the significant discounts that apply to private companies. For example, a lack of marketability discount because you're restricted from trading or selling those interests in most cases, and then lack of majority control. You rarely get any vote, much less will you have a controlling vote, so that's a pretty hefty discount. And then there's assorted other discounts that involve you may not be able to refinance when the partnership thought they were. They may not be able to sell it. They may not be able to rent all the units or experience the rental rate growth that they projected. There's a number of things that enter into those discounts and allow, the bottom line is, it allows you to convert with a lower tax cost than if you had your money invested in Apple stock or AT&T, et cetera. Now, that's not to say that if the market drops on a given day on your Apple stock value, yes, you could. That'd be a great time to consider converting to Roth if you're trying to do the same strategy with marketable assets that, you know, have a stock market exchange where you can look at the end of business that day and say, well, the price went down 10%. That would be unusual, obviously, on most stocks. But, yeah, you can take advantage of that and get a lower tax cost. But, again, that's rare, whereas with multifamily investments, every deal you invest in theoretically is going to be a non-tradable, non-marketable scenario where you can count on some pretty hefty discounts. So if you're interested in learning more about that, please go to our BAPlanner.com website. That's BEAPLANNER.com, and consider completing the forms shown on that forms page. Link is at the top right of the website. Let us learn enough about your facts and circumstances. Tell us about your retirement money, and then go book a call at the link furthest to the right, and we'll be happy to explain more about how we might be able to work with you. Let's see. I meant to say when we're looking at the debt clock a moment ago, I wanted to mention that the Social Security liability and the Medicare liability, out of that $212 trillion in unfunded liabilities, they are approaching $70 trillion between the two of them. Just in case you're worried about your Social Security and your Medicare coverage, again, this is going to be systemic policy changes that we're going to have to address, and it better happen fast, because 2029 to 2030 is going to be the most significant depression this country's ever seen. Okay, well, we're at the end of the show. I hope you enjoyed today's show. Appreciate you tuning in. Look forward to being back again this coming Friday at 11 a.m. right here on KSEV Houston. That's AM 700, and we hope you can tune in. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and join us again next week for another edition of Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.